Okay, welcome to the fourth iteration of CogSci 200, the Temporal Dynamics of Learning. Today I'm very happy to have Mike Moser here. Many of you know that Mike got his PhD here with Don Norman and Dave Rommelhart, and started life as a connectionist and did such interesting things as learning to do music with neural networks using Bach propagation.
That was Gary's joke, not mine.
No, you did that. Was that your joke?
I would never say anything that dorky.
That was your joke. The other joke I pulled on Mike was when he was giving a NIPS talk one year, and he was using one of these laser pointers, and I had a laser pointer in my backpack, so I was in the back, you know, pointing at the same and moving my pointer around on what he was pointing at while he was giving his talk, and he couldn't figure out why he couldn't control the laser pointer. So I'm very glad to have him here because he's going to help us out with our site visit on Monday.
By that, he means I'm going to sit in the audience for half the day and then leave. Revenge!
Anyway, so today Mike's going to talk about work on the temporal dynamics of practice. Take it away, Mike.
I've been given orders not to stand in front of the screen because it changes my facial contrast or something, so I'm going to try to stay anchored here throughout the talk and point with this stick, which is all I have to point with. So I tried to give this a temporal dynamics of theme. This is a project that encompasses a bunch of very specific models I've worked on over the last 4 or 5 years, and it's not represented within the center, but I thought it was something that made enough contact with things that are should be going on in the center that that I would like to be going on in the center, that I would talk about it. And here's my best recollection of the center, of some of the different projects. So I guess the CogSci class has already had speakers on STDP, which happens on the time scale of milliseconds. I know there are projects like EMO has project on motor adaptation, which is on the time scale of minutes. And I'm sort of reconstructing one of Gary's very nice slides here, so forgive me if I got some of the details. Javier has done this work with Ruby and social interaction, and Andrea's done work on habit learning, which seems to be operating on the time scale of hours or days, and Hal Pashler and I have been working on a project on spacing effects and fact learning, which goes on the time scale of weeks or months, and Gary's work is on perceptual expertise, which can span into the timescale of years. But if you look at this figure, you see there's just something that seems to be missing from it. And what I think is missing is a phenomenon called sequential dependencies, which occur on the timescale of seconds. And that's what I want to talk about today. So let me give you a very simple example of a sequential dependency. So suppose I give you a sequence of arithmetic tasks, like add 34 and 82, get 120. Add 48 and 26, get something else. Then add 3 and 1. And it turns out that people, if you've given them a sequence of hard problems, slow down a lot on the easy problems. And it works in the other way around. If you give them a sequence of easy problems, they're faster on the hard problems. And it's a speed-accuracy trade-off. So if they slow down, they're more accurate. And if they speed up, they're less accurate. But the time it takes you to respond and your behavior on a task, your speed-accuracy trade-off point, depends on the sequence of problems you've just been solving. Another example I just remembered this morning from my childhood was your friends would give you this list of words, and they'd all be like names of Scottish people, like McNeely and Macduff. And then the last one would be machine, M-A-C-H-I-N-E. But you'd read machine as Machine, and your friends would point at you and laugh. So that's another example of a sequential dependency. Here's an official definition. So when a task is executed repeatedly, experience on one trial affects the performance on subsequent trials. Performance here can be measured in terms of response time, accuracy, the type of errors people make, how they resolve ambiguities, and what sort of choice they make in a task that where there's multiple responses. Some varieties of these sequential dependencies are just called priming. Most of them are fairly short-lived. They last for about sort of 5 trials. Some persists much longer, up to 100 trials. And they occur sort of across the spectrum of cognition. And this is a table that I have a couple more entries for. I didn't have time to put them on the slide. But these sequential dependencies occur in various components of the cognitive architecture, from perception to response initiation, attention, and language. They occur across a variety of experimental paradigms and experimental tasks. The dependency, sort of how one trial is affected by the past, can be a very concrete feature, like color of a stimulus, to something far more abstract, like syntactic structure or the difficulty of a task. And here's just a bunch of examples of papers that have focused on sequential dependencies. The ones in yellow are projects that I've been involved with modeling, two of which I'll tell you about today. So I'm going to tell you about these two projects that are pretty unrelated, and then try to sort of wrap up by coming back to the basic principles that underlie both of these modeling projects. And the main, I know you guys probably don't care about the particular domains I'm going to be modeling, but my goal is to convince you that these models are reasonable accounts of the phenomena, and by coming up with models that are reasonable accounts, we can sort of look at the model and say, what is this model saying more broadly about how people are handling sequences of experiences over time? And how our behavior changes from one trial to the next. So the first model is a model of ordinal category learning. What are ordinal categories? Well, they're any sort of categories that have some intrinsic structure, like Starbucks coffee cups, small, medium, and large, or whatever the Starbucks terms are, letter grades, A through F, weather forecasts, sunny, scattered, clouds, overcast, and so on. What's special about ordinal categories is that when you learn something about one instance of a category, you learn something about the other categories. So if you walk into Starbucks and say, I want a medium coffee, and they give you this big cup, you know something about what a large cup would be and what a small cup would be. And so there's this extra source of constraint on learning, and it results in behavior observed in sequential dependencies that's very interesting. And let me first describe an experimental paradigm and tell you the basic result they find in these tasks. So the studies will involve stimuli that vary on a single dimension, like let's just talk about disks that vary in diameter. And suppose the task is more or less arbitrarily to define four intervals and call those intervals category A, B, C, and D. And they're ordinal categories, so A is smaller than B is smaller than C is smaller than D. There have been a series of experiments in a classification paradigm where the subjects are shown examples, they're shown a disk, and they're asked to produce the right category label, and they get feedback after each trial as to whether their categorization is correct. And there's an analogous task, which is a production task, where the subject instead is given the category label, and they're asked to produce an instance of the category. So they have a mouse to control the diameter of a circle, and they're asked to generate a circle that has the right diameter for that category. It turns out the two paradigms, even though one's a production, one's a perception task, give very much the same sort of results. The production paradigm is a little bit more informative because subjects are generating sort of continuous sized disks, so you get a little bit more data. So I'll talk about the production task. So let me give you a qualitative description of the main phenomenon. So in order to give you this qualitative description, let's assume that the subject has in their head some notion of a prototype, sort of where the category center belongs. And these prototypes may or may not be aligned with the true category centers at any point during learning. Here I've drawn them right in the center of the regions. So to look at sequential effects, we have to look at how seeing a particular exemplar, or producing a particular exemplar in the production task, affects exemplars that the subjects produce in the future. So imagine a task where the subject was just told, produce an example of B, and they produce a disk that looks like the exemplar there. After producing, there's two phenomena. One is called within-category pull. So after they produce an exemplar of a category, the category prototype shifts toward the exemplar. And I'll say behaviorally how we measure that in a second. There's another phenomenon which is really bizarre and which is what motivated me to work on models of this with my collaborator Mike Jones at Indiana. There's a between category push. So after subjects produce an exemplar of a particular category, the prototypes of all the other categories shift away from the exemplar. And the weirdest thing is the shift is greater with the further distance from the prototype. So D moves more than C after having seen an example of B. It kind of goes against your intuitions about how category boundaries should shift. So let me tell you the particular data that underlie this description of the phenomena. And to do that, I'm going to switch focus now and not ask what happens to all the other categories after I've shown you a B, but I'm going to ask what happens to B based on the category, the previous category. So here's my prototype for B right in the middle. And either that prototype will move to the left and go toward green, or to the right and go toward red. And that's represented here by the relative length of category B, which is reflected in the mean diameter of the response to B as a function of the previous category label. Does that make sense? So I can ask, if I've just shown you an A, would you expect the response to B to be shorter or longer than average? So let's play that game for each of the different responses. So I've just shown you an A, and because of this phenomenon that I called the between category push, B gets pushed away, it goes more toward red, and so as a result, A results in a production of the next item B, which is longer than average. Over the B.
I don't understand what this.
What the y-axis is?
The y-axis is the B response. Okay.
Yeah, the y-axis is the B response. So this is, you ask the subject to make a circle of a certain diameter, and you ask, what diameter will you get from the subject that's along here as a function of which item came previously? And so I'm just saying, if my description of push and pull is as I say it is, this is the pattern of results you'll see. So there's A is the previous category. Now here's C is the previous category. The exemplar from C pushes B away, and now B shifts to the left because C is to the right. And so because B shifts toward the green line, the average diameter for the B disk gets smaller. And likewise for D, and because there's this effect that grows with the distance, because category D is further from B than category C, the push is greater, and so the response of the subject will be even shorter still. Now, if we talk about what happens with B as a function of the previous trial being a B, sometimes, because this is within a category, they'll be pulled toward the right, and sometimes they'll be pulled toward the left, and on average it will stay about where the average length is. And so you get a pattern like this that's diagnostic of this within category pull and between category push. Make sense? So here's actual data from subjects. Is the A, B, C, D are for the four different categories, and the black dashed line is an average over the different categories. And so you see this sort of downward sloping line, and that's for the production task, and then on the right is the classification task, which is measured in terms of response bias, probability of responding with the neighboring category, but it's the same basic measure. Okay, so everyone's following that? So I want to come up with a story about this sort of sequential dependency of how your performance on one trial depends on the previous trial. The two models I'll tell you about today, one for this task, one for a different task, are within a probabilistic framework. So within this framework, I'm representing the things you're trying to learn as random variables. And so each category, I, is represented by a prototype, call that Z of I, which is where it thinks the center of the category is. And that prototype is along the dimension that discriminates the categories. So just to be clear on notation, when I have a capital Z sub I, that's a variable whose value is to be determined by the human learner. A small z is following the convention of probability. It's a value of a random variable. And then I'll use a boldface Z to represent the set of prototypes for the four categories in these experiments. So the idea is, early in the course of learning, the subject doesn't have much idea where the prototype goes. So there's a lot of uncertainty associated with the four categories. But over time, as they gain more experience on the task, the uncertainty shrinks and that distribution shrinks. So that distribution, just to be really clear, because it's not what people usually are thinking about, it's not a distribution over a category. It's not a class conditional density saying what's the probability of a certain disk size given a category, but rather it's a distribution of uncertainty over where the prototype for the category, where the center of the category should be. Okay? So, in this model, I assume that the prototype distribution is a multivariate Gaussian, so the set of prototypes is Gaussian distributed with a certain covariance matrix that can represent the dependencies among the different categories. And then there's this very simple generative model that says a particular exemplar, so this would be a model of the production task most directly, a particular exemplar is produced given a category label, that's C, and given the prototypes, that's Z. An example is produced by drawing from another normal Gaussian distribution whose mean is where the prototype is with a certain amount of variance. So you could think about that variance as sort of production variance. The subject wants to produce an example of the prototype, but they're a little sloppy. Okay? So this is pretty much all I need to assume to make predictions from the model. To model the production task, yeah. Oh, sorry. C is the category label,
yeah.
Just A, B, C, or D.
Yeah.
Sorry, I know it's confusing because C is the label and and Z is where the prototype is along the axis. So think about Z as a numerical value. So, you know, 1, 2, 3, and 4 for categories A, B, C, and D. Okay? So, sorry, I keep wanting to point. This specifies if we know Z, I know I'm not supposed to go over there. If we know Z, then we can specify what the distribution is over the exemplars that are generated. And this says what the distribution is over Z, but we don't really know Z, so we really want to integrate out over Z, given this uncertainty in Z. And that gives us the probability of drawing an example given a category, and that turns out to be very straightforward. That's also Gaussian, and it depends on this mean and covariance and that variance. And so this little Gaussian distribution specifies the probability that in the production task the subject will draw a particular exemplar given the category label that they're asked to produce. Okay? Yeah?
So since we're in this model, your C and Z are independent,
That's right.
So I'm just confused because Z decides the mean of
Z. Just think about Z as a vector, so it has all four prototypes. And then C is indexing which of those prototypes.
So
Yeah, sorry. This is meant to be a boldface Z for a vector of the prototypes. Yeah, thanks for asking that. And the same model can be used just by flipping things around in the Bayesian way to model classification. So if we have P of E given C, we can say, given an example from the subject, what's the probability that the subject will classify it into a certain category, and just use Bayes' rule to do that. Okay? So it's a very constrained model. It has two different dimensions of freedom, and one dimension is a learning rule. So as the subject's performing this task, they have to learn from their past experience and the feedback they've gotten. And so this learning rule specifies how to update the parameters which specify the joint distribution over the z's. So if we have a time index, then the parameters for the mean and covariance of that z vector will be a function of the current covariance as well as the example you've just seen. So this specifies a learning rule once we can specify this function. And there's two different learning rules we explored. A sort of stupid one, which is a gradient ascent rule. It just says, it's very like neural net learning rules that say we're going to make little changes to those parameters of the z random variable so as to make it more likely that the exemplar would be categorized correctly. Okay, so we're going to sort of shift the category boundaries around so that the example becomes a better example of that category, whether it was an example you produced of the category or whether it was an example you categorized. Here's a much smarter thing to do, if you're a Bayesian person, is a Kalman filter update, which is the optimal way to use the evidence that's provided by the trial's exemplar and the category label. So it's a way of doing sort of Bayesian re-estimation of the uncertainty distribution of the prototype. So it corresponds to a graphical model that has this sort of time dependence among the parameters. But basically what you need to know is sort of dumb rule and really cool rule. Okay? The other dimension where the model, we have freedom with the model, is how to represent the prototypes. So what I've described to you so far is pretty much a localist representation of prototypes. So in a localist representation, there's sort of a one-to-one correspondence between the prototype for a particular category and a random variable. So that's just the way I was describing it to you. We have Z has four elements, and the first element of Z the vector, the first element of Z is the prototype value for category A, second for category B, and so on. What this doesn't do is exploit any constraint about how the Zs are interrelated. In particular, because these are ordinal categories, the subject knows that Z of A has to be smaller than Z of B, has to be smaller than C of C. So we thought we should try another sort of representation that would correspond more to a distributed connectionist representation, where the variables we use to represent Z are fewer than the number of prototypes we want to represent. So here's one possible representation. Suppose we represent the prototype for some category I with two variables, Z1 and Z2, and that, say, the prototype is Z1 plus I minus 1, Z2. So Z1 basically specifies where A is, and if I is an index that starts at 1 for category A, 2 for category B, and so on, Z2 specifies what the separation is between each category. Okay, so that's making a strong assumption, which is the categories are equally spaced. Right? But the cool thing is, now I have two variables that represent all four categories. And so it's a constrained representation because I have fewer variables and I have category boundaries. So it's incorporating a constraint, which is a very strong constraint in this case, on the fact that B has to be to the right of A, C has to be to the right of B, and D has to be to the right of C. And each one has to be the same distance to the right as the previous one. Is that making sense? What we actually used was a slightly less constrained model with three random variables, one sort of counting distance from the left and the other counting distance from the right. But the main point is, because we have three variables to represent four prototypes, there's an extra amount of constraint here, and that constraint is basically embodying the ordinal relationships among the categories. Yeah?
So I guess it seems like there are two issues that conceptually might differ between localists and distributed.
Uh-huh.
So one is what you're pointing out, that you could represent the number of category prototypes with a smaller number of variables, so it's more. But I guess there's another issue you're not saying here, which is that, in a sense, the localist representation also gives probability mass to distributions of prototypes that really violate the ordinal constraint.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't explore an intermediate position where you basically like renormalize the localist representation.
So even in the localist model, I don't think it ever, because it's getting supervised training. It's never going to, neither the learning rules will cause the learning to violate the ordinal constraints. There'll never be a sort of learning step that moves A to the right of B, because you'd need to have sort of evidence. If you start them off in the right relationship, they'll stay in the right relationship.
Yeah, I mean, but it's just a multivariate Gaussian over positions, right? So there's still going to be finite, like non-zero probability mass for outcomes that violate.
That's right. No, that's right. And you're saying, could you renormalize it to give those probabilities zero? Then it wouldn't be multivariate Gaussian anymore. It would be ugly. But that's certainly another way to go that's in between. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so I've described two learning rules and two category prototypes. And the one thing in the last 20 years I've learned about modeling is don't go around to the world saying, this is my favorite model, but rather you try to be this objective sort of passionate scientists, say, I'm going to explore all these models and see which ones are most consistent with the data. So I'm going to build four models here and see which of them, if any, will explain the phenomena. I had to do a little bit more math to do this distributed thing, but you don't want to see that. So onto the push effect, here's the human production data that I told you about. And the first thing I did was built three of the four models, the models that I liked, the Kalman filter models that I thought would work really well because they're the sexiest thing to do, and they did a horrible job. And essentially the Kalman filter models, this is the Kalman filter model with a localist representation, with a distributed representation, they're both too efficient at using the evidence. It only takes a few trials and they basically home in on the right answers. And there's ways to add noise to those models, but still no amount of noise would reflect the sort of human performance, the time it took people to learn. So I had to rule those out. And this localist model, I could tell you a long story about why it gets that pattern of results, but essentially each category only learns about its neighbors. So when you have an instance of B, it affects A and C because they get pushed away, but the guy further away, D, doesn't learn. And so you don't get this increasing push with distance effect. And even though the way I gave the talk, the setup for the talk was this 2x2 design, when I actually built the models, I hadn't really thought it through like that, and I was ready to give up on this whole project, and finally I had the realization that it was this 2x2 design, and hooked up this model, because I already had the code from the bits and pieces of the other models, and just bam, it nails the data. So it also produces, to the right magnitude, the same sort of push effect and pull effects that we see in the human data. So let me go on a little bit with this model and say, can it explain some of the other phenomena in the experiment? So, before I go on, let me say something about the push effect. So the push effect has this weird sort of implication that anytime you learn about a category, all the other categories are pushed away. And the model tells a very different story. So if I plot, as a function of trial, where the model's prototype, the mean of the prototype distributions are, one thing you see right away is that all these prototypes are sort of jiggling up and down together. And in fact, what happens on any one trial is if this is an exemplar of category B, B is pulled toward it because that increases the probability of that exemplar given that category. And if the example is to the left of B, B is pulled to the left or the right. And it turns out on any particular trial, all of the prototypes are pulled in the same direction. And that's why you're seeing them all jiggle up and down together. And you can kind of see why that would be, because if B wants to get smaller, given this representation of the prototype, one way to make it smaller is make Z1 smaller, and another way to make it smaller is to make Z2 smaller. And when you make Z1 smaller, it shifts everything to the left, and when you make Z2 smaller, it compresses the set of four prototypes. So you can see that sort of any change I make to Z1, any change I make to Z2, is going to affect all prototypes, perhaps to different amounts. And so it turns out that the push effect is realized by averaging over trials. It's not what happens on any particular trial. And I could waste 20 minutes to bore you to give you my analysis of this. But when you combine over a bunch of trials these effects where all the categories move to the left or all the categories move to the right, and you average over these individual trials, you get exactly this push effect that makes it look like the guys further away are being pushed more. So the model gives us an interpretation of this push effect, which unfortunately is a lot less interesting than the original push effect. It also is able to capture the pull effect, so we can look at the correlation of, in the production task, the diameters produced by subjects on two consecutive trials when the two trials are in the same category, and look at the correlation. That correlation gives us a sense of sort of how strongly, if one is shortened, is the other one going to be shortened, or if one's lengthened, will the other one be lengthened? And the human data and the model produce very similar correlations. And these push and pull effects diminish over the course of the experiment. So if you look at how much variance there is in the responses, humans produce more in the first half of the experiment versus the second half. The simulation also shows that decrease. And then accuracy increases steadily over the course of the experiment. So here's the model over the course of the experiment, and it matches more or less human data. And then the model makes a prediction, which we went back and found an experimental result that supports it. This is, as a function of number of trials, how much pull is going on, sort of relative to a deviation of zero, and how much push is going on. And the model always produces more pull than push. And here's some evidence we found indirectly from the categorization task that suggests this is correct. So suppose we talk about, this one's a hard one to get right. Suppose I ask, how do people perform on an example like this, given that the previous example was within the same category and there was a pull? And how do you measure how well they do? Well, if this category prototype is being pulled to the left as a result of this example, then this boundary is also being pulled to the left, and this example is more likely to be judged incorrectly as an example of category D. So we can look at the error rate to see sort of how much this category boundary has moved to the left after a pull versus the same example, but after a push. So we've just seen an example of D. then this boundary as well as this prototype are pushed away. That will also produce more errors here. But if there's more push than pull, or more pull than push, then the error rate here should be higher than here. And it turns out that it is. The error rate on this guy is higher in this case than in this case, even though the distance of this example from the previous is the same in both cases. So, yeah.
It seems like your diagram should include the fact that seeing C is also, should also push D.
Seeing C.
On the left diagram, C gets pulled, but D should get pushed at the same time. Right?
Yeah, you're right.
But that's the opposite is true in D, right?
Yeah, in this particular case, it's right in the center, so it kind of works out nicely. But you're right. No, I mean, this is a kind of crude analysis. But given these guys being equal distance either within a category or between categories, a sort of naive model that says the amount of push and pull is the same should predict same magnitude. Okay, so I want to move on because I didn't want to bore you with the details of this particular task. So just to summarize this part of the talk, I've told you about two learning rules, two representations of category structure, and found that only one of the four models I could build out of these four combinations fit the phenomena involved in ordinal category learning. And this model that worked has Bayesian inference to produce and categorize examples. It has a simple, not too exciting learning rule, gradient ascent. It's not as smart as people could be, so for those out there who like to go around saying people are Bayesian, it's really not that sexy. And kind of a cool aspect of the model is that we can take advantage, or we can claim that people take advantage of ordinal relationships among categories by building this kind of distributed representation that introduces dependencies among where the four category boundaries are. I think the model gives us some insights into sequential dependencies in this particular domain. For one thing, I argued to you that the push effect, which looked really interesting and bizarre, is the result of trial averaging. There's no way to see this experimentally because you can't see push effects on single trials. You can only measure it by averaging over trials. So experimentally, behaviorally, there's really no way to verify this, but this gives an interpretation to the phenomenon. And the sequential effects that are observed are part of learning, so that what I built into the model was a learning algorithm, nothing to produce sequential dependencies per se. And the sequential dependencies that arise in the model are just a result of the model's attempt to capture the structure of its environment, to model where the prototypes are in the space so that it can perform well on the next trial. So that's part of my punchline for the whole talk that I'll get to, is that these sequential effects just reflect trying to learn something about the structure of your environment and model the structure of your environment. So what I want to do briefly, I think I have about half an hour from when I started, I want to tell you about a totally separate model in a very different domain. And the reason to really switch gears like this is just to make the point that even though these domains are so different, that the same sort of principles are operating in sequential dependencies, I believe. So what I want to tell you about is visual search. And a few of you may have heard this spiel before, and I apologize. This is a couple-year-old project. So visual search is something we do all the time. You find your wallet in the crowd, find your wallet in your office, find Gary in the crowd, find your car in the parking lot. And it's really amazing that our visual system can do these very different sorts of tasks. And somehow the same processing hardware has to be reconfigured to find Gary versus find your car. There's a second question which seems unrelated to the first, but I'd argue that they're very similar. The second question is, how does the visual information processing system fine-tune itself? God, I don't know what English I actually wrote here. How does visual information processing tune itself to the environment? And the reason why it's the same sort of question is because finding Gary in a crowd that consists of Berkeley hippies is going to be very different than finding Gary in a crowd that consists of NSF site visitors, right? In the site visitor case, you know, Gary's hair will be a distinguishing feature. And in the crowd of hippies, it would be his gaiter, his beard.
My dog.
Your dog, that's it. So the point is that in different environments, the system has to reconfigure itself, just as for different tasks, the system has to reconfigure itself. And it's my belief that looking at how the system tunes itself to the environment will tell us something about the same control processes that are involved in understanding how the system tunes itself to different tasks. So I'm going to tell you about some sequential dependencies involved in tuning to the environment. And the particular experiments come from a paradigm that Vera Malkovich and Ken Nakayama developed. And it's a simple task, a simple search task. It's find the oddball in color. So find the green thing. And then tell me, there's a little notch taken out of it. Is that notch on the right side or on the left side? So here the right answer would be right. This is a very efficient search task for people who know about visual search studies. The hard tasks involve looking for conjunctions of features. So I'm not telling you find the red thing that's notched on the left. I'm just saying find the oddball in color, which just pops out at you. You're very fast in this task. And report something about the notch. And the point of asking you to report about the notch is just to make sure you found the object, right? Because the subject has to search for the oddball and then report something about it. The interesting question from the perspective of sequential dependencies and adaptation is, if you have a trial like this, it could be followed on the next trial by another target which was the same color, also green among red, or the target could switch color. It could be red among green. And so the question is, will people perform differently depending on the sequence? And sure enough, they do. It turns out that people are much faster if the target color stays the same than if it's different. And that difference is really due to a difference in performing ability because the error rates are about the same. It's not just a speed-accuracy trade-off. And it's a pretty big effect, right? Isn't this, Hal, in the scheme of psychological effects, 100 milliseconds for an 800 millisecond response time? And it's really impressive. That's whopping. It's not like you have to run thousands of subjects. They probably ran two because they're psychophysicists. So I'm going to tell you about a theory of why these sort of repetitions help performance. And it's based on the idea that attention is trying to optimize performance by tuning itself to the environment that it's operating in. And so there's a two-stage process involved in that. First, to construct a model of your environment, a predictive model that can say how likely is this event versus that event. And so it's a probabilistic model. And you construct this model based on your past experience. And then secondly, once you have this model, you can kind of tune up your attentional system to optimize performance under that particular view of what the environment is. What does it mean to tune up attention, or I wrote here, tune control parameters of attention? Well, without going into a lot of detail, here's everyone's model of attention. It involves taking a visual object, analyzing it, we lost some resolution here, along some different primitive feature dimensions, sort of picking out the horizontal, vertical, green, and red stuff, and then taking the activities in these individual feature maps, adding them up to get a sense of saliency in the visual field, and then guiding attention to the most salient locations first. And where control comes in is that you might imagine having different weights on these maps. So rather than these maps just adding up linearly, having weights on these maps that are set based on some sort of control process. Make sense? And so the parameters of attention would be these gains of the feature maps. What I want to focus on, though, is just this building the model of the environment based on experience, and then, as I'll tell you about, just assume that people optimize without explicitly building the optimization. So what I have to tell you about, though, is how you build a model of your environment. And so what is the environment here? Ugh, it's losing lines. Honestly, on my screen there's a bar here. So what is it in this particular task, what's the environment? Well, the target has a particular color, red. It has a particular size. In this case, I made them small and large just to add extra features. They can be notched on the left or the right. And likewise, just to make the exposition simple here, I'm going to assume all the distractors are homogeneous. The model's doing something a little more sophisticated. So if they're all homogeneous, then they're all green and small and on the right. So with six features, I can describe that particular configuration in the display. And to make a prediction about what stimulus, what the display will look like on the next trial, I can specify a model as a joint probability distribution over these six variables. And in this case, in my simple example, each variable has two values. Okay? So if I have this model, then I can tell you how likely is the target to be red on the next trial or green on the next trial. So the goal of learning, of capturing statistics of your environment, is to build this model. So how do we want to build this model? Here's a simple way to do it. You just assume the features are independent of one another, so that the joint probability over all these variables is just the product of the marginal probabilities. But that's not a good assumption to characterize real environments, right? It's not that features occur randomly. I mean, Gary's beard co-occurs with his hair. It's not that they're sort of flipped on and off independent of one another. So this is too simple of a model. Here's another model.
Wait. Yeah. Can you go back? So your model doesn't say anything about the target features being in the same place or
This particular model isn't representing location, and I don't know if anyone's done studies for this particular task to look at whether repeating location affects things, but I could embellish the model to include location.
But, I mean, you're doing visual search,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You have to find
the thing
you're searching for.
Yeah, but location. So this isn't so much about finding it as it is saying, what am I expecting next? So I can tune up my system. So if you're expecting a red target or a big target, you might tune up certain features to guide attention through those gating weights in the sort of standard attentional model.
Okay, so and then the second thing was that this doesn't seem to have any temporal dependencies in it.
It doesn't now, but when I tell you about how this probability distribution is estimated, it's going to be updated from trial to trial. So that's where the sequential dependencies will come in.
Okay,
so this independent features model is too simple. Here's another, is to model the full joint distribution, build a big lookup table for every combination of these six variables. If they're binary variables, then we have 2 to the 6th entries in the table, 2 to the 6th minus 1 free parameters in the table. But we have to specify, oops, sorry, another line's missing, a probability for each of these different configurations of features. And if you think about learning this, it's going to be hard because you're going to need to have sort of at least 64 experiences, probably many times 64 experience, to fill in those table values with any sort of confidence. So just as the first model was too simple, this one's too complex to allow for learning. So I'm going to propose instead a model that's somewhere in between, and I'll call it a task-based architecture for reasons I'll explain here. And the architecture will be based on representing it as a Bayes net. So Bayes net is just an efficient way of representing probability distributions over a large number of variables in terms of simpler distributions. So each node in this network is a random variable. Each link represents a conditional dependence. And links also represent tables of values. For example, size, color. This arrow represents what's the probability of the target being a certain size given that the target is a certain color. So I need to consider for each combination of target colors the different sizes and fill in probability values. And then the full joint distribution over these variables is represented as the product of each variable conditioned on its parents. And so I can write out this full joint in terms of a bunch of smaller conditional distributions. And the punchline of this whole thing, if I have it in the right place on my slide, is if the independence architecture I told you about corresponds to a Bayes net with no connections among the nodes, and a full joint architecture, here's one instantiation of it, where every node is connected to its descendants if you order the nodes from in any arbitrary order. The full joint architecture, as I told you, has 63 degrees of freedom. The independence architecture only has 6 free parameters, 6 degrees of freedom. And this task-based architecture has 11 degrees of freedom. So if you imagine this continuum between a model that has very few parameters but not much representational flexibility and a lot of free parameters but a lot of representational flexibility, then this guy is somewhere in between. And what's interesting about it are the particular claims I make about why I have the links I have. So this is totally arbitrary at the moment. What I'm going to do is explain to you the principles that led me to come up with this architecture, okay? So 1 second of patience. So there's 3 assumptions that allow you to specify this architecture. And basically, you can take a description of the task and build the architecture. So the first principle is, and we use this to model a bunch of different experiments, so we can take the description of the experiment. So there's a certain feature that defines what the target is. Here it's color. And we make that the root of the tree. So the target color is always going to be the root of the tree, because that's the feature that you're searching for. Then I made up this term dominates. But to indicate that there's an arrow from one node to another, I'll say that that node dominates another node. So the defining feature of the target dominates the defining feature of the distractor. So that says there's a link from target color to distractor color. And the defining feature of the target dominates the non-defining features of the target. So even though the targets vary in size and where the notch is, this is the defining feature. So I'm going to draw arrows from the target to these other two nodes. And likewise, the same thing for the distractor. So there's a link from the distractor color to its size and notch. Now, this may not be the process that actually generated the stimuli, right? This is a generative model that says, how could you create displays? And that generative model may not correspond to the actual generative process in the experiment. But the claim I want to make is, given a description of the task, that you're looking for the oddball in color, and that the items also vary in size and where the notch is, that description of the task allows you to construct this model. So there's sort of a one-to-one correspondence between task descriptions and models you can build.
So does dominate mean the same thing in each case, so that at the root? So if the target color dominates the distractor color, that means?
That arrow.
Well, what does dominate mean exactly?
Oh, it just means I've drawn an arrow from that to that. Maybe. Oh. Okay, but By drawing an arrow, I'm specifying something about how this joint distribution is represented. So let's go back to the BayesNet slide.
I just don't understand what that is.
So yeah, I mean, I think the problem people are having is maybe how does the distractor color depend on the target color?
Are you asking how in the world does that happen, or?
Well, this net is supposed to do something.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's supposed to do something, at least in part, in virtue of the arrows. And so I guess I'm being told that the arrows aren't causal. And
right.
And in some instances, it looks like it means something like, if this is my target, then that's not. So it looks like maybe mm-hmm. you're talking about conditionals
yeah.
here. But,
right.
But,
so.
And it's supposed to be, in some way or other, a simplified version of the whole shebang BayesNet, which nobody wants.
Right.
So I guess I just don't quite get how it's working.
Okay.
The arrows tell you exactly the bottom line of that thing. The joint probability can be written more simply in terms of that other line just because of the particular arrows that are up there. The arrows say that you're conditionally independent of everybody else given your paths if there's
So let me step a couple steps back,
okay.
And then we'll get back to what Ginny said. So I claim I want to build a model that says, how likely is any configuration of the environment? If I can predict how likely the different environment configurations are, I can tune myself meaning the attention system, to be optimal for that particular environment. So we need some model that represents the probability of different states that you could encounter. And there's lots of different ways of representing that probability over these variables. So I talked about the independence architecture and the full joint architecture and said that one's too weak, one's too strong. And this is somewhere in between. So basically, I've sort of made claims about what dependencies there are. And as Ginny was explaining, once I've drawn a picture like this with the arrows, I can specify the full joint distribution as a product of a bunch of conditional distributions. But because I've removed so many of the arrows, these distributions are very simple. So I don't need a lot of free parameters. I need a way of representing how likely is it that the target color is going to be large given that it's red? How likely is the target to be small given that it's red? And so if I build a bunch of these small tables that are represented by these arrows, then I can put them all together to get a full joint according to this model's prediction, which may or may not correspond to really how dependencies work in the world.
So still, I mean, you don't need the arrows direction to write that way, right? I mean, direction, which
the direction is just notate is sort of Bayes net notation that says if you want to write out the full joint. Well, because if it's a Markov random field, and we're getting a little bit separated, but if it's a Markov random field, then you have to specify what this joint distribution is, whereas, or you have to specify some sort of energy function over pairs of variables. And I don't, this is a more constrained sort of thing, right? So given some amount of data, some certain number of trials, it's really easy to build this table. This can come directly from the world. So a Markov random field has a little bit of extra flexibility that we don't need. I understand that in most vision applications, people use Markov random fields. But think about this as being a little bit more removed, more abstract, as just sort of a representation of contingencies among high-level features in your visual environment. So I've made these three assumptions, and I call this a task-based architecture because these three assumptions are all based on the task that you've been assigned. So if I had told you that I want you to find the guy that's an oddball in size, this architecture would be very different. So the different architecture would be constructed for each task. So let me give you the sort of big picture about how we can use this to model data. So we set up a Bayes net for each experiment based on this task description. I generate a sequence of trials that replicates those that were used in a particular experiment. After each trial, I have to update the environment model, and this may be the key piece that's been missing. And it's more sophisticated than this, but I'll just tell you the simple version. But suppose you've just seen a display like this. Well, you've just seen a case where the target color is red. And so your probability that the target color is red, which is one of those distributions you're maintaining as part of this Bayes net, this should increase. Likewise, the probability that the target size is large given that the color is red should increase. You don't really know what should happen to the target size given that the color is green, because in this particular case, you can only learn about what happens if the target color is red. And likewise, what's the probability that the distractor color is going to be green given that the target color is red, this display provides evidence for. So on any particular trial, a display provides evidence for certain conditional probabilities to be sort of more likely given the environment that you're operating in. So to a first order, what the model does is basically say, I'm going to take my old model. Versus, I could build a model based entirely on this current trial, which would say probability target color is red is equal to 1, probability the target is large given that it's red is equal to 1, and I can interpolate between the two. And so I can take sort of a bit of the old model and then incorporate a bit of the probability based on the current display. It's just meant to give you an intuition. There's actually a smarter Bayesian updating thing that's going on.
Basically, what you're saying is you're constantly learning the parameters of the environment in some maximum likelihood way, and so given that this is my new observation, I should, you know, move my average towards red for target colors.
Yeah.
And so that causes a temporal dependency because what I just did changes my probabilities because I'm learning.
That's exactly right. And so if you go back to the categorization model, remember I told you about two learning algorithms, the dumb one, which is just doing a sort of gradient ascent. That's what you were assuming was going on here. And then there's a smarter one, which is doing the right Bayesian sort of inference. And it turns out this model is actually doing the smart Bayesian inference sort of thing, not just doing a maximum likelihood thing. But it's the same sort of distinction, that you're doing an updating based on each trial, and what you're updating are statistics of your model, or statistics of your model that allow you to predict something about what the next display is going to look like. So that's how these two different sets of simulations tie in. So once we have this model, there's a part I'm not going to actually implement in this simulation, which is you want to optimize attentional control for the current model. So if you think the target's going to be red, you should pay a lot of attention to red features in driving attention, and you should turn up the weight of the red feature. But instead, what I'm going to do is the system optimizes itself in a way that reaction time is related to the minus log probability. So more likely configurations in the world will produce faster reaction times. And the reason for making this assumption is, well, first of all, there's lots of models that assume a log relationship between probabilities and response times. But the main reason for making this is I don't have to model the whole attentional control side of things. I can just make this assumption and only build a model of the environment and make predictions about reaction times on the next trial after I've updated the model based on this formula. So I can take a sequence of trials, build this model, and then I can predict what reaction time will be for the next trial based on the features of the next trial and plugging them into my model of the environment and assuming reaction time is related to minus log probability so that more probable states produce slower, faster reaction times. Okay, so let me show you some data real quick. So here's this task, the original task I started with. There's a singleton in the display of red and green diamonds. You have to report whether the notch is on the left or the right. And you can ask the question, how does the color a certain number of trials back affect the response time on the current trial? Here's the human data. So this is how far back in the past you go. And either the target on the current trial is the same as the target one trial, three trials, five trials back, or it's different. And so you can see, if you ask sort of as a function of the last trial being same or different, there's a big difference in response time, 560 milliseconds versus 600 milliseconds. And that effect squinches down over time. So once you get about five trials back, the effect goes away. So the last four or five trials are affecting, if you buy into our model, your representation of the environment that you're using to make predictions into the future. I don't know why they also have a graph looking at sort of what future trials effect they have on the current trials, so you wouldn't expect that to be anything other than zero. And here's the model. It gets a nice fit, and there's one free parameter in the model that basically specifies this decay. You can think about that averaging example I showed you as saying sort of how much of the old and how much the new do you take. That's the only free parameter in the model. Everything else comes from the sequence of trials. And we set that parameter to get sort of the right qualitative decay to the experimental results. Now, what I won't go through in a lot of detail is a whole series of experiments, and the model does a really nice job of fitting the results. So I'll tell you about this one, for example. So in the last experiment, you could get faster when you repeat things, either because the target color was repeated or the distractor color was repeated. Because the displays only have two colors, red and green. When you repeat one, you have to repeat the other for the other guy. So here, there were four distinct colors, and they did sequences of trials where the target color was repeated, but the distractor colors were changed. Or the distractor color could be repeated here, but the target color changed. So you could independently look at what a repetition of the target color versus a repetition of the distractor color did. So it turns out, as a function of sort of the how many you've had of the same color, of either the same distractor color or same target color, you get speed up with the number of trials of either the distractors or the target, but you get more speed up with the target. And the model, no free parameters here, gets the same effect. And the explanation for why you get more speed up with target versus distractors comes from the fact that we're representing what's the probability of a distractor color given a target color. So you're only updating that conditional distribution after a trial for given the current target color. And so if you've just seen a red target, you're updating what's the probability that the distractor is going to be blue or yellow given that the target is red. But you don't have any evidence for what's the probability that the distractor is going to be blue or yellow given that the target color was green. So there's sort of fewer updates for your estimate of the distractor color than the target color because we've conditioned the distractor color on the target color, or I've said that the distractor color is dominated by the target color. So it's that dominance relationship that produces this effect. Because I am at the point where I'd like to be when I was done and I'm not done, I'm going to skip a lot of stuff. Here's an experiment that Hal and Li Kuang did a few years.
Well, we've still got 25 minutes.
Okay. How about if I skip that one? Hal left already, anyhow. He had to go to a different talk. I will tell you about this one. This is really the last one. This was a sort of tour de force that Jeremy Wolf and his collaborators did. So this is a slightly different paradigm. So you're detecting the presence or absence of a singleton in a display of colored oriented lines. And there'd be a block of trials, and they'd correspond to environments of varying complexity. And so here's an environment, here's a sequence of trial where the environment is really homogeneous, where the target's always red and the distractors are always green horizontals. Here's a distractor that's still simple, where the target could either be red or vertical. So here the target is present. Here the target's absent. Oh, no, it's present. Here it's absent. Here it's present. Present. Okay, so the subject's responses would be let's see, this one should be absent unless... No, that's present, and that's present. Right, because your job is just to find the oddball. So here there's an oddball. Here there's an oddball that's in color. There, these guys are all the same. This is an oddball. This is an oddball. Okay. So there's a little more variability from trial to trial. Versus, you could have a very complex environment where the target is just the odd item, and there's no other constraints. So, you know, the target could be a red horizontal or a green... red horizontal, red vertical, green horizontal, or whatever else. And you can measure how long it takes subjects to find the target or respond on target present trials for these different blocks of trials. So here's the data from Jeremy. This is data that Jeremy gave me the raw data for, and I reanalyzed it because he had like 8 conditions and had a bunch more complicated things. And I just sort of simplified it. I won't tell you about these, but this is the pattern of results Jeremy got. And this came by me taking his raw data. He had these very complicated graphs with not, I said 8, but it's really more like 30 points on them. And I reduced it down to these points. And I'd already actually run the simulation, so this is a true prediction from the model, and I already got this out of the model. So the model does a nice job of matching what Jeremy later gave me the data in a form. Okay, so let's go on and say there are these other sorts of accounts that people have proposed, and they correspond roughly to the independence architecture I told you about in this full joint architecture. And it turns out neither of these sorts of models can explain the whole set of data, only some of which I've told you about. And so, as you can see from the big red X's, these two models are wrong, and our model seems to explain everything. And it's a really powerful model. I swear, it only has one free parameter. Everything else comes from the task description and the sequence of trials. It's very much constrained in the same way that that categorization model I told you about. So there's two ways of viewing this architecture. One, you can see it's a model of the structure of the environment. But as I've used it here to predict reaction times, it's a model of attentional control. And the fact that these two things are really one and the same in the model suggests that it's a rational account. That is, that what appears to be cognitive control is a consequence of optimizing performance to the structure of the environment, given particular restrictions in our representation of the environment, which are those restrictions I specified in the task-based model. So it's a somewhat different view of attentional control. It's sort of a rational view of control that comes about from sequentially over time building models of your environment. I'll skip that. I can come back to that if you care about that. So let me just wrap up and we can have some conversation. So I've told you about two domains. I've told you about categorization with ordinal categories and the simple visual search, simple in the sense that the displays are all pop-out displays. And they make one common claim, which is that in the ongoing stream of experience, people try to build predictive or probabilistic models of the environment which they use to guide behavior, and that these models are updated as the result of each experience. So I would want to claim that this is learning on the time scale of seconds, of experience to experience. So let me just finish up by saying just a little bit about what I've learned about this time scale of learning from studying different tasks. So we all know that people practice skills that they want to acquire, like musical performance or, you know, doing calculus. But I see us going through our lives doing a much more mundane sort of practice constantly. I put this in the abstract. So, you know, you're looking for your car keys, you're judging whether the fruit is ripe, you're choosing what to order for lunch, you're reading printed words. And you'd kind of think, these tasks are tasks you do all the time, you've had so much experience in, they're simple, they're overlearned. Your practice, your past experience shouldn't have much effect, yet all of these sequential effects seem to point otherwise and say that there really are these strong effects of your recent experience on pretty much any task you perform. If you look across the range of sequential effects, you see that in most domains, just four or five experiences are enough to tune performance, and beyond that, and you saw that in that exponentially decaying history trace of past trials in the Nakayama experiment, there really isn't much speed up that goes on beyond that. This sort of tuning happens each time the task or the environment switches, and it's regardless of the past experience you have with the task. So it's not a case where you become an expert and then you don't need to do any tuning. The tuning is just going on all the time. It turns out from a variety of experiments that performing the task is necessary. Just telling people, I'm going to give you a red target next trial. That's not going to be enough to tune up as if you've just seen three red targets in a row. The sort of tuning that goes on here can be to very abstract features. I've done some modeling involving stimulus difficulty manipulation, and you can manipulate the difficulty in lots of ways, but subjects are predicting the difficulty, like that arithmetic task I showed you at the beginning. And Bach has done some experimental work showing you get this sort of priming of syntactic structure. So having just produced a sentence of a certain syntax, you're more likely, or having just heard a sentence of a certain syntax, you're more likely to produce a sentence with the same syntax. And the kind of line I'd like to push, and where most of my work has gone, is to say what I hinted at in the attentional task, that a lot of what we see is cognitive control, as the brain sort of rewiring itself to the particular task demands and our current goals, can be interpreted just as a consequence of building models of your environment and then optimizing performance to that environment. And so you can get rid of control homunculi. Now, beyond talking about optimizing performance, there are domains I'm working on as well where instead of saying you're doing this explicit sort of optimization, like tuning up those weights in the attentional model, that you can see the optimization is just another sort of inference based on the model you've built to the environment. So there's really no optimization going on. It's just all Bayesian inference all the way through. And that solves control problems. And those solving those control problems is reflected in these sequential dependencies. So thank you very much. Yeah.
Can you go back to the slide where you show the advantage of the target versus distractor polarity? Yeah. Okay. So I'm a little bit confused about something. So I mean, another way of thinking about the causal model or the Bayes method with regards to these data is that actually the distractor dominates target, right? And if you had done that, would you have actually gotten the reverse?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, but I'm a little confused about this because those two models specify exactly the same set of constraints on the probability distribution, right? So, is it the nature of the priors that you're putting that determines that?
No, it's the nature of the updating. So, that's a good question. So, as I argued here, if you've seen a display like this, you can revise your belief in the target size being large, given that the target color is red, because this condition is true. But you can't change your beliefs about whether the target's going to be large or small, given that the target color is green, because you haven't garnered any evidence about that from this trial. So, depending on what you say dominates what determines when you can sort of update your which elements of the model you can update on any particular trial. So let me use this as an example. So these are all conditional distributions and one unconditional distribution that are part of this task-based architecture. One of them is the probability that the distractor color is going to be green given that the target color is red. Right? If you're repeating the target color every time, you can repeat, then the target color is always red and you can update your belief in what the distractor color is going to be. But if instead we repeat the distractor color, but change the target color, if on one trial the target color is red, then we update our belief in a particular distractor color given the target color is red. But now if I change my target color on the next trial, I make the target color yellow, you won't have any, your probability of the distractor color conditioned on the target color being yellow won't have been changed by this particular trial.
But isn't that implicitly happening because your probability of the occurring color being in a particular form is also being updated?
It's sort of, if you condition one variable like distractor color on another variable like target color, you can only revise your belief in the distractor color given that particular target color. And so that limits how often you can update your model about distractor colors. And so if you switch the target color, updating the model for the color being red won't tell you about anything about what happens when the target color is blue. So. And so it's because I've specified that particular order of dominance that that I get more effect for repeating the target than repeating the distractors. So it's a qualitative assumption in the design of the architecture that we use throughout our simulations. And in this particular simulation, it produced the result we wanted. In some of the others, it sort of interacts with other things to produce the effects. And I certainly agree that our architecture, those three claims I made about how you build the architecture, totally arbitrary. But there are three qualitative assumptions that about sort of how you represent your environment based on the task description, that once you make those assumptions, you can get quantitative fits to a bunch of experimental results. And it seems kind of interesting to me in the sense that it makes total sense that based on what task you're told you're doing and what you think your environment is like, you build a very different model of the environment, right? If you're trying to avoid getting run over by cars, you're going to look for different features of cars than if you're shopping for a new car. So based on your task, you code your environment very differently. And that's the fundamental claim here.
Question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, I don't want to lose what I learned last Saturday. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't want to be thinking about cars during my work
week. So there's two different things going on. There's sort of like taking your initial description of the task and coming up with a first guess about how to do the task, right? And that clearly has to benefit from having done it before. But then the sort of fine-tuning where you're really specifying your performance to the task in some way, you need the experience to do that. And the best literature for seeing that is the task switching literature. So there are experiments where I'm going to show you, say, two numbers. I don't know this literature very well, so if anyone wants to jump in and correct me. I'm going to show you pairs of numbers, and then I'll tell you on each trial what I want you to do with them. So add them, subtract them, subtract them. So you're switching tasks every once in a while. Other times you repeat the task. And even though, you know, we've done addition and subtraction problems for however many years, when you the time it takes you to do a subtraction problem, given that you just previously did an addition problem, is slower than if you previously did a subtraction problem. And when you look at sort of how many subtraction problems in a row do you need to do before you reach your asymptotic peak in response time, it's, you know, sort of one, the one trial has a big effect, and then after four or five trials, you know, you don't see any effect at all. So it's amazing to me, but you'd think you could just sort of maintain these different task sets and you just swap them in and out. There's something about learning by doing. Yeah.
So it makes sense that when you're doing, so all the examples were something where it increases the probability given that you've just done something previously, which makes sense in the world that you're going to increase your probability once you've just experienced that or seen that. But say you were given a task where in the environment, in the task, and in the instructions in the task, that isn't the case. So you get something red and that makes something green, which makes something yellow, and you catch onto that.
I'm actually doing experiments with Sean Vissera, a psychologist who studies attention, that we impose these kind of arbitrary consistencies. What little I know about the literature, and again, someone wants to jump in, you can tell me. I know that when you impose arbitrary contingencies, that people are doing this sort of extra inference step where you kind of have to translate things. But that's in things like, well, when I show you an arrow pointing to the right, that means the target's more likely to be over here on the left. And you have a little bit of time to sort of correct what the arrow tells you into a prediction. And it's the sort of thing that's done consciously. But I'm not sure in these tasks, like for example, in this attention task, telling subjects that the next target's going to be red doesn't help you. So my guess is if it takes any sort of explicit rule following to flip around a cue, that it's going to make these effects go away, then you won't be able to see that kind of benefit on the time scale that's happening here.
So I'm still
You've been very nice so far, Gary.
I'm still
Don't blow it.
Target, what?
Don't blow it.
I'm still stuck on the target dominating, the color dominating the distraction color question.
So, look, anytime...
So, I know, you know, I believe you and all that, but that's why targets update faster or whatever. And if you did it the other way, you'd get the opposite result. Mm-hmm. But I still have no idea why this should be the case. So to the extent that your model fits the data, no parameters, great. But I still have no idea why one should think that the, because, so you're saying it's because that's the task, is to find that target color.
Let me give you a kind of snide response, right? You didn't ask me in response to the categorization model, you know, why did you believe that it's doing gradient descent learning and not Kalman filter updating? I mean, I tried models of both, but if I...
I didn't say anything then because members of my team were still arguing about what the PowerPoint template should be over email for this site visit talk. Attention.
Okay. Well, let me restate it more generally. Anytime you build a model, you start with a certain number of assumptions, right? And it's nice if you can give some rationale to those assumptions. But the real question is, can you make a relatively small number of assumptions without, you know, sort of, in this case, these are three qualitative assumptions. I'm not sort of tweaking parameters. And you get out beautiful fits to the data. This is like the coolest model in the whole universe, right?
It's sort of like, three guys on the island with a can of beans, and there's the engineer and the physicist and the economist, and the engineer has some way of opening the can, and the physicist has some way of opening the can, and the economist says, assume a can opener, right? So it's like you've assumed the thing that explains the data, but I don't understand it.
I don't know. Why do you assume principal components analysis in all your face models? Something you do.
It's handy. I could assume, you know, I could use ICA, I could use lots of other things.
Yeah. Well, let me say one thing about this. So the first version...
This is kind of critical.
Yeah. So the first version of the model we did, we wanted to do the right Bayesian thing, which was to basically imagine every possible graphical model you could build, sort of any set of dependencies. And in the space of models, you can do updating over the models. So based on an observation, you can say, how well did this model, which had a certain set of links, fit the data, predict the data, versus some other model predict the data, and then revise your beliefs in the models. And what should happen over time is that the system should converge with high posterior probability on the model which actually reflects the generative process in the particular task. When you do that, it doesn't fit the data. So that's, again, you know, you'd like to say, oh, the brain's nice and Bayesian and it does the right sort of inference. But that's a limitation, I would want to claim, on how this cognitive system works. That it's not that powerful, but rather it has these sort of heuristics that say, this is a reasonable way to represent the environment given the task description that's been given to me. I think at that level that's very well motivated, right? To say that how you want to represent the environment should depend on the task description. It's also well motivated to make the feature which is most critical to you to be the fundamental feature. And it also makes sense that because the target and distractor are discriminated based on a particular feature like color, that there should be some dependence between them. So, and
you know, why should this dominate these guys? Well, it's more fundamental, more important than this. So I can kind of come up with a story, but again, three qualitative assumptions, 25 different numerical differences. Dave, did you have a comment?
You just answered. I was like, why not go hierarchical?
Yeah.
Since adding parts increases the expressivity of the model and we require more data to get an equally strong fit of data to predict whether you've got the right parts by how many pieces of evidence the subjects appear to need to get a certain quality of parameter estimates.
So you're saying if I sort of add extra dependencies, like, you know, add a link from here to here so this guy has two parents, then I'd need to collect a lot more data to fill out his conditional distribution. And then maybe the sort of learning that people do is just too fast to be reflected in a model like that, which would have to fill in a table with a lot more entries now. So that is the sort of argument you can make, but it's kind of a generic modeling thing, where if you say, I can come up with three different principles for how to specify a model based on the task, and my model can explain the data as well as your model, well, then it sort of knocks some of the wind out of my sails, right? Because, you know, there's a bunch of models in this space that can explain the data. But just to beg out here, it's never any one modeler's problem to come up with all the possible models that can explain the data. So, I mean, this one's a simple one in the sense that it's making only three assumptions, and all the variables are dependent on just one other. But I think you've given me some sort of argument for why this is a reasonable model, which is namely that it updates very fast, but yet it still allows for the representation of dependencies among variables. But you could definitely disprove it if you found that there were some sort of three-way interactions with sort of how they responded to distractor size as a function of both target and distractor color, and you had to condition this guy on both of them, then you could disprove this model. So it makes predictions that you could test as well. Yeah.
I also have a specific technical question back on this original question. If you can go to the slide where you show the derivation of the particular string of conditionals. Assuming again that we did flip the dependency, or as you call it, dominance between target and distractor color.
Yeah.
Doesn't that change? Well, I guess I meant the slide where you say what conditional distributions you can update based on a particular piece of evidence.
Oh, yeah. It would change that, yeah.
Right, so wouldn't that, I mean, because we haven't changed the distributions we can represent by flipping that arc, that's the exact same set of expressivity.
It has the same number of free parameters, but it's not exactly the same distribution. So, you know, I can take this and blow this up into a table with 64 entries, right?
Well, there are arcs in BayesNets that you can flip without changing.
There are. I'm not sure if that's one. Yeah. So, flipping that arc would flip this guy to be distractor color of probability of target color given distractor.
It seems there's an equivalence class.
Those would be equivalent, right? Yeah.
It seems that there's an equivalence class then of particular arcs here that would have the same.
Yeah.
Once you made the right changes to your rules of evidence integration.
This is a tree, right? Because if it's a tree, then the base net is equivalent to the Markov rank field. So the direction of the
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So there's two different issues. There's expressivity of this, sort of what probability distributions it can represent, and then how that plays out in the updating. And it's the updating, as I said earlier, where putting the arrow in this direction is different than putting the arrow in this direction.
So it seems like you're going to have to change your updated rule based on flipping the arc. And it surprises me that once you updated the rule correctly, that there would be a difference in the two different procedures, given that both procedures. But
it's asking you to do a weird thing. I mean, I have this one on the board. So this says, given that the target color has a certain value, what should the target size be? And the sort of updating you're talking about says, well, if I see a target that's green, I can still make a prediction about what the target size will be conditional on the target being red. And it's like you had no evidence.
No, I'm trying to change that. So by flipping that arc, you're changing the set. So if you go to the slide where you show how you're going to update, these won't be the same.
That's right.
And so you are only going to make the correct inferences based on any piece of evidence.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that you're going to come to the same, you would generate the same joint distribution.
You'll have to convince me offline that the updating can be equivalent regardless of how. Yeah.
If we were doing maximum likelihood estimation of parameters, right, directionality wouldn't matter.
It wouldn't?
It wouldn't, because the expressivity is the same as the ultimate resulting optimal probability distribution.
No, but.
If you're doing maximum likelihood, there's a space of multiple parameter values, you're particularly optimal. You change how you represent the space, it's still
going to
have the same
options. Let's see, that would depend on the models being equivalent, and I think they would be here. Okay, I'll buy that.
Yeah, so that's why I was asking originally about the priors. It seems that actually the nature of the priors and how that plays out, because you can have representationally equivalent base nets that wind up being
I'll agree with you. So the real model that underlies all this, which I didn't want to show because it's really ugly, is that the probabilities that go into these conditional distributions are themselves random variables, and you have a prior distribution over them. And there's also a prior distribution over the environment changing. So the model is doing a sort of temporal updating of the or temporal integration of the parameters, but it allows for the possibility that the environment is switched and I have to do a reset. And the one free parameter of the model is really the probability that the environment resets itself. And when it resets itself, it does reset itself back to priors. But I'm not priors over the distribution of this probability value that itself is a random variable. But I'm not sure that those priors are really important. I think we just,
It might not matter what the priors are, but the structuring of the model can have an impact.
The structuring of the model will have an impact. But what I'm describing here is how the proper Bayesian model works, is that only certain of the probability, the uncertainty distributions over the probability values are updated, and it's only the ones for which there was evidence on the current trial. And so what I'm saying is true, but I'm not sure how that.
I think we're just thinking it doesn't uniquely pick out this set of
arcs. Yeah. Well, I absolutely guarantee you that if I flip that target and distractor arc around, that the resulting model will give you a different result.
But do you also correct these updates?
That follows automatically. Yeah.
But each of these rules is learning through
Bayesian update. Each one is there's a Bayesian update.
That must be what the first one
would be. Okay, I need to think about this more, but you guys have definitely helped me sort of sort through this. And you're totally right, just in terms of the representational capacity, I believe. That these things are all pretty much equivalent. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.